Welcome to Straight Talk with Carlissa Thorne. And I'm really happy today because I get to re-interview a wonderful author who's written so many books, it's just imaginable that I get to now get to do a new book of hers, which is Communicate Like a Leader. And I have with me today the wonderful, and I can't be, no, this is really, I have to say this because I can't tell you how many times I've screwed up her name. This time we are not going to screw up her name. It is the wonderful Diana Buhr. And so today we're actually going to all talk about communication, which is a wonderful topic and a dear topic of mine. So I always like to read bios, and I have to say that her bio is so lengthy. I'm going to let her say a few things about the things that she loves to talk about. So Diana, you have written so many books. There's so many books to touch upon. I want you to tell me and the audience, what are some of your favorite books that you've written? And then we're going to dive into your book. But you've written so many of them, and I really like so many of them. I'd love for you to share which are the ones that you like.
Well, I always like the one that I just finished. Now, I'm always excited about the one that has just come out. And the reason I like this one is because it is really a compilation of things that I've worked on for 30 years of my career. I go back and I think, what are the things that people have asked me about throughout? Every time I go into a new organization or I'm coaching, I just think, you know, what are the questions that I get over and over and over that people want help with? And that's what I put in this book, and that's why I'm so excited about it. But the one that came out about 4 or 5 years ago, Creating Personal Presence, it sold a lot of copies, and I think it's because that one helps people really jump when they get stalled in their career and they're ready to go to that really high-level position, and they don't know what's holding them back. A lot of times their boss can't give them any feedback, or their client, and they say, well, you know, they're brilliant at what they do. I don't know why they're stalled there. It's that those finishing touches that they seem to need. And that's what I addressed in that book, Creating Personal Presence. And I guess if you gave me a second choice, my second favorite, it would be that book, Communicate with Confidence. And the reason I like that one is because it is so comprehensive. It's like everything you always wanted to know about communication. It has 23 chapters, over 1,200 tips, and it's one of those books you can pick up, put it down, pick it up, put it down. You don't have to read it all the way through, but if you've got a specific issue, like I've got to apologize to somebody and they hate my guts, well, they don't want me to apologize to them, you could just pick up that one little section and read 2 or 3 pages and pick up a tip. Or let's say you think, I don't have any authority with this person, and they just don't believe I'm credible. You can just pick up two pages and read that little section, how to establish your credibility with somebody who believes you have none. And so it's, you know, just the go-to book for a specific issue. You don't have to read it all the way through, but it just covers everything on interpersonal skills. So those are my two favorites, if it's not the current book.
Now, I also know you've written for like Huffington Post, Business Insider. Do you regularly write for any specific publishing, like magazine, or those are just things you've been in?
Well, my weekly blog is picked up by Huffington Post, so I'm always in there every week. And then the CEO magazine publishes, but a lot of magazines like Eat Magazine and Fast Company just, you know, picks up an idea they've seen on my post, and they'll ask, you know, can I do a special version or a special topic that they like? And I send them something original. And so I have a lot of original articles that appear in the media frequently. But those, the Huffington Post and CEO Magazine and Faith Happenings, I write for every week.
Okay, now what section of Huffington Post would they look for you in?
In the business section. It's just under my name. I'm just a weekly contributor, weekly columnist there.
That is wonderful.
Business topics. I don't really even know how they break it down, but I'm in the business section, business communication.
Yeah, I thought I really wanted to touch upon that because I know you're all over the place, and so I really want to touch upon people, where can they find you besides, you know, obviously your website. And I wanted to put that out there now because a lot of times sometimes people listen to the whole thing, some people listen to the middle, some people listen to the end, and obviously when I put together the blog post, yes, it'll have your website and all that. But it's always important, I think, like just so people know where they can find you. And I know you've written, you're so prolific, you know, you've written, I also want to know, how many books have you written? I think this is important for people to know.
Well, this last one that came out in June was the 47th book. I've done some compilations with other people, contributed a chapter here and there. But my own books, 47 books, most of them have been business books. About 30 of them are on the topic of communication. So that's my passion. I am all about communication, business communication, and interpersonal communication.
And I that's why I love you. I mean, it's like so many people write, I mean, I write a lot about various things. I'm very passionate, but they all have a common theme, obviously. And your common theme, obviously, is communication, which is something I absolutely love. It's so important. I don't think people realize how important communication is. So I just love you for that. So let's get in. Go ahead.
Really, nothing happens unless you communicate.
Exactly.
You don't have a relationship with people. And your relationships are communication encounters stacked end to end. And in business, I always said, nothing happens until somebody communicates. They either write, they have a meeting, they have a phone call. Something has to get communicated before you have any kind of business interaction. And the same thing in your relationships.
And people, I don't think, realize how important in relationships it is. I mean, that's a whole nother topic and a whole nother interview. However, let's get to, we're now going to be talking about leadership. And I think a lot of times reason why leaders fail, in all honesty, is they don't know how to communicate. They think they're the leader, they're the alpha, and what I say goes, and they don't know how to really communicate with their teams. To me, everything is about collaboration, and it's we, not an I conversation. Without the we, there is no I, and I'm about collaboration and we communication. So I really like to touch upon that. So let's get into your book a little bit. So I'd really love to understand from your point of view, what is the real difference between a real leader and a manager? Because for some people, you know, they want to manage everything, I think. So let's get into what your terminology in your book is. You actually discuss that. What is the real difference between a real leader and a manager?
Well, I think if you had to boil it down into a very succinct concept, I think a manager is a maintainer. They come in and they maintain what's there. They maintain the processes, the relationships, everything, and it's the status quo. A leader improves the situation. So when they leave, the assets, their department, if they're in a big corporation or if they're running their own company, things are better when they leave. So they're going to improve the processes. They're going to improve the value of the relationships they have. They're going to have those vendor relationships are going to be better. Even if they just manage some little sliver, if they're just managing the delivery dates on a project, things are going to be better. There's going to be a shorter delivery time. So it's just one maintains status quo and one improves the value of what's going on.
So we touched upon a manager, and this is something I know for me is a pet peeve. You talk about micromanagement. So what do people do when, you know, they're dealing with a micromanagement person? Like they're so, you know, tied into their micromanagement.
Well, that basically is the essence of the book, Communicate Like a Leader. I have said the goal of it is it prevents micromanagement before it happens. Because if you think about it, micromanaged people are extremely frustrated because they know, or they feel at least, if their manager does not trust them, because somebody is always looking over their shoulder and they're always double checking. And so gradually what they do is they do worse and worse work because they think, I don't have to double check myself. Somebody's looking over my shoulder to double check me. So it's like in writing, I might as well just turn in a first draft because somebody else as an editor is going to be looking over my shoulder. So whatever they're doing, whether they're, you know, writing or doing meetings or managing a project or negotiating a big contract, whatever, somebody else is going to catch my error if I'm going to make one. And so why do my best? Now, if you're the micromanager, of course, you are frustrated because you're thinking, why can't they do their job? I'm having to do their work and my work too. And I hear that from a lot of senior people. They say, can you do something about Tom? I'm having to do his work. Well, the reason they're having to do Tom's work is because they're trying to micromanage and they don't know how to delegate. And when they don't know how to delegate, they don't do it properly. They are doing the job of two people or three people or 10 people, however many people they're trying to micromanage. And it's frustrating all the way around. And it is a problem of distrust. Neither party trusts the other. The person who's being micromanaged doesn't trust their boss to let them do the job, and so they always are checking back so they don't get, quote, in trouble. And the person who's micromanaging doesn't trust the other person to be able to do the job. And so it just snowballs.
I agree with that. It's like they get very frustrated, both parties, and it's weird, and it becomes this combative thing, and then it just, like you said, snowballs. And it can be.
That's true. When I put something on Facebook about micromanaging, I probably get more comments on that than anything else. There must be a lot of people out there that are micromanaged.
I have to say that I would say probably about 80% of people get micromanaged. I would have to say it is a high, unfortunately. That's what I've seen anyway. You know, we talk about hiring, and I know you actually talk about that in this book. You talk about hiring. And what can you actually give people an advice, you know, against hiring toxic employees? And how do they go about reading? How do they actually know that they're hiring? Like, how can they discover? I mean, you know, what tools do you give people to actually discover they're hiring toxic employees?
Well, I think it can be discovered in the interviewing process. I think there's some key questions that you ask people to find out their personality. I think you need that to hire, both on competency and character. You can teach some people a lot of things, but you can't teach them attitude and you can't teach them personality. And I suggest hiring them for those things, to discover those things before you get them aboard and see the havoc that they're creating. For example, you can ask questions like, you know, you remember that Judith, I think it's Judith Viorst book, you know, about the terrible, horrible, very bad day that the main character has, you know, the children's book. You can ask a question to an applicant. Have you ever had a really, really bad, stressful, horrible day? Well, tell me about that day. Well, as they tell you about it, what you're listening for is, you know, what do they consider that's horrible? And how does that measure up against what you consider is horrible that happens every day in your department? And were they able to get themselves out of it, or did they have to call somebody else to rescue them? And how did they what kind of words did they use to describe it? You know, how long did they have to take off the job to recover from that terrible, horrible thing? And what did they use to describe their attitude during that thing? I mean, did one little traffic jam or a minor fender bender on the way to work, you know, knock them out for 2 days and they just couldn't, you know, cope? Those kind of things tell you. And do they blame other people? It was always somebody else's fault and nothing was their fault. Those kind of things give you big hints about what it's going to be like to work with them. And you can ask them questions like, tell me somebody that you admire in the pop culture or in your community. Or who did you not like to work with? Everybody has some people they just really don't prefer to work with. Hear how they describe them. Well, those are going to be the same kind of attitudes they have about people that are already on your team that they're going to have to work with. So you can find a lot of attitudes out during that interview process, and I think that's what you need to look for. You can always train people on how to do a job, how to handle the process, but it's really hard to interview a 35-year-old or a 55-year-old and change their whole attitude, change their whole outlook on life. That's hard.
Well, yeah, something about can't change old dog tricks. What is that?
I think you've heard that one before. That's right.
You know, I don't know. You know, that's a hard one too, because you know you kind of want to not discriminate. So that's a really hard one. You know, but again, you know, there are some old people that are open and flexible. But again, you have to just, like you said, use those key questions to see if they are flexible, right? You know, that there are people that are.
Right.
So,
and we're not talking necessarily about age.
Right.
Some people are set in their ways at 30.
True, true. Even in their 20s. It's true. So, yeah, absolutely. So, Let's talk about some other things. So you said in your book that that millennials, as well as others, expect their bosses to be great mentors. And with the lean workforces today and the fast pace we have, how do managers have time to add this to their to-do list? I mean, y'all, you know, when we started a job, you look to people and everybody wants mentors. And, you know, we're all busy. And they're like, what? You want me to be your mentor? Like, how do you expect me to have time to do that? So how do we get people to see that maybe that's not their job, but at the same time, maybe how do we get them to see that maybe it is? I mean, that's kind of a catch-22 situation.
Yeah, I think about mentors like this. People, when they hear the word mentor, and they're the one that's being expected to do the mentoring, they think, oh, just like you said, oh, one more job on my to-do list. I don't have time. But I think what they need to focus on is it's not a to-do. It's to do as you do. And what I mean by that is look for what I've called mentoring moments. And that is just time to invest in another person as you go about your job. It's not something to add onto your job. It's to do while you do your job. For example, what I used to do when I had a new person on the job, when I was running the former training company, now I am more slimly staffed. But when I had someone that was brand new and everybody wasn't trained up, trained completely like they are now, I would say, Rachel, can you step in here? I want you to hear this conversation I'm about to have with this vendor, because when I turn this over to you, you need to have a background on it. Now, that didn't take me, 15 seconds to tell her that? Because when she listened to that conversation, she would know how I was negotiating that. And the reason, maybe when I hung up that conversation, I might say, now the reason I made that comment to that vendor was, and I would give her 2 minutes of background. Well, if I do enough of those conversations with enough people in front of Rachel, she will gradually have the background on that relationship with the vendor. So if I'm gone, or if I let her take over handling that situation, she'll have that background. She'll be mentored in judgment about other relationships. So that person, that millennial that you're mentoring, will understand you're making an investment in them. When you start to go to lunch, if you say, hey, Brian, I'm on the way to the cafeteria, walk over there with me. I'm going to explain why I made such and such decision. I just decided to cross so-and-so off our bidders list. Let me explain that for you. Brian will immediately understand that you're investing in his career to understand about the judgment in the bidding process. Those are mentoring moments that I've called. They don't add to your list. You're just mentoring while you're doing your job.
I look at it also as, like, you know, the old parables or whatever is like, you know, do unto others as you'd want done unto yourself. So you can be the example. If you're literally on task and if you're actually being as you want, you know, want others to actually be. So if you're in that moment, like you said, and people can then, that is mentoring moments. If you're actually, you know, if you're in the mentoring, if you are the mentor, you know, if you're actually acting the way you want people to be, then they actually are being mentored, whether you know it or not. And then, like you said, if you're actually pulling them in into moments, and they are moments, you pull them in to be just a listener in a meeting. Then they're not necessarily having to be engaged in the meeting, they're listening. You pull them into an elevator as you're going down or going up. Like you said, walking to a cafeteria, walking even to your car. Those are moments. They're not actually adding to your list.
Right. And you may take a few extra minutes here or there to explain your reasoning behind what you did or how you decided something. I picked that up years ago when I first started my business, 30 years ago, in hearing an administrative assistant. She said, I frequently will call, she reported to a CEO, and I was astounded. She, 30 years ago, she was making a six-figure salary as an executive assistant. I was blown away, you know. In the early 1980s, a six-figure salary for an administrative assistant. And she says, yes, she said, I know more about this company probably than every executive vice president here, because she said, I observe, I hear, I have all kind of dignitaries from other countries coming in here. It was a big oil company. And she said, I can act on behalf, and my boss gives me authority to act on his behalf when he travels extensively. And she says, that's because I listen to his phone conversations, I hear his visitors, I sit in on his meetings. And when I don't understand something, how one department works or how this contributes to our profit, I say, hey, can you, I have a teachable question. Can you give me a 2-minute lesson? And she said, I'll step into his office. And I said, why did you make that decision? And why did you do something? In 2 minutes, he explains the reasoning behind it. And she says, you know, I've become invaluable to him. I can run his personal business. He trusts me to make financial decisions for him. I pay all his bills. I handle his estate. She said, I just settled his mother's estate when she passed away because I know all about his personal business. And I just thought, what a great example of those mentoring moments. And when I wrote this last book, I thought, hey, that's what I'm going to call it, mentoring moments. That's what she had done all of her life. And that's what I've done for my employees through, as I hired them. I just wanted them to know this is what I'm doing, and I want you to know why I'm doing it, so that if I'm not here, because I've always traveled a lot as a speaker, you can make that same decision, because you need to know the why behind it, or you do know the why behind it.
One of the things that I love is you also talk about why it's important for leaders to have a sense of humor. There's nothing worse, like for me anyways, going into meetings, and people make meetings, I mean, literally people are like, you know, literally, like, they do not want to be there. They're just totally not present. So I know you touch about them in the book, and I was thrilled, because it's like, why is it important? I mean, I think it's important for anyone to have a sense of humor, let alone a leader. And I know most leaders don't. They feel like they have to have this face, a facade of, I'm the boss, I'm the leader. Leaders aren't supposed to have a sense of humor. And, you know, God forbid they laugh at themselves. So why are you saying it's important for leaders to have a sense of humor?
Because humor opens people's mind. If you don't have some kind of release when you're in a stressful situation, you just blank out sometimes. That relaxes people. It lets them be creative when they can relax and not be, when you know yourself. We've heard from police offices, from the military, all of these security agencies, that when people are so stressed, they cannot think well. And if you've got to think in a self-defense situation, in a very tense situation, you have to remain calm. So when you need people to think innovatively, they need to come up with great solutions, they need to be as stress-free as possible. And humor does that. Now, I don't mean to sit around in a meeting and laugh when it's inappropriately and you're discussing a serious business situation, but there has to be freedom to crack a one-liner when somebody thinks of something funny, to make a tongue-in-cheek remark, to lighten up the situation occasionally. It doesn't waste a lot of time. It just releases the tension for people.
So segueing into that, because you mentioned about that, not having to have a sense of humor. How many times have you gone to hear a speaker speak and they have no mastery of speaking? I think only, like, literally, I don't know which is worse. So you also talk about in your book how important it is for leaders to literally learn how to speak, like, literally, you know, to have that mastery. You know, you have to have that sense of humor, but literally, if you are going to be a leader, you have to know how to speak. So again, how important it is for a leader to know how to speak, to be able to be on, you know, whether you're, and that's the other thing, you know, being in a boardroom to on stage is no different. I mean, you still, the skills are the same.
Right.
In my point of view.
It's a nice to have skill to an essential skill for a leader. It's just become a fundamental skill, because now, because of technology, whereas in the past a leader could hide, they could create the ideas, they could explain a concept and then have someone who's better on their feet to go out at the board meeting and make the point, or stand up in a boardroom and make the point. But now people are saying, hey, we have the technology. No, we want you, CEO, we want you, executive vice president of marketing. You're going to be the one on camera. You're going to do the webinar. You're going to be simultaneously broadcast to the entire all-hands meeting for our employees. And if you are not skilled at speaking, you're going to create a very bad impression. people judge you by your speaking ability. And if you can't express the point, they're not going to think, well, yeah, but he or she is pretty good on their feet. No, they're going to think you don't know how to do your job. I don't care what your job is. They're going to think you do not know how to do X job just because you can't communicate about it. So it's become an essential skill that you speak about your job, whatever it is. I don't care if it's painting the side of the building. If you cannot explain how you paint the side of the building, you're not going to do well in corporate America. Or in governmental agencies either.
You're just giving me amazing, beautiful segues. You just said painting, and in, like in your book, you talk about spray painting and social media, so to speak. And you know me, I love social media, and I get really frustrated if people don't, in a lot of ways, use social media effectively or abuse it or over abuse it. Anyways, so what is your philosophy on using social media for business?
Well, I think it's become essential now, but you need to know why you're using it and have a strategy. You know, a few years back, it was more or less experimental for most people. It was kind of, let's just get out there and see what happens. Let's just get out there and throw a few things out and see if people respond and see how many followers we can get. But now it's all about engagement. And you can't get engagement everywhere on every platform. So my philosophy is to choose one or two platforms. Let's say it's going to be on Twitter and Google, or it's Google Plus, or it's going to be on Facebook and Instagram, wherever you have your audience, wherever you think these are this is my tribe, these are my people, wherever they are, choose one or two platforms where you can reach those people and get them to engage with you. And we know that followers, having a large number of followers, I mean, that's good, but it's not necessarily true, because you can buy followers anywhere else. You can do things that get followers, but it's how many of those people will actually do what you want them to do because you've said, so to speak. How much influence do you have with those followers? Some people have a large number of followers, and those followers don't even recognize when they send a tweet, don't even recognize when they do a post. It just gets lost. So it is, how much influence do you have with how many of your followers? And do they listen to what you say? And will they actually go do what you say when you post or tell them to do something? That's what really counts. And giving them value. So that's what it's all about. And most people then use that social media platform to drive people to their website so that they take some action. And that's part of the strategy as well.
Right. And so I agree with the focusing on the one or two platforms. But then again, there's also like sometimes another platform, there's certain platforms that do certain things, whether we know it or not. Like, for example, you don't usually use Google to Google isn't really a place where you're gonna have conversations and engage, but you do use Google because it creates SEO presence. So
yes.
like you said, so that's not gonna be one of your two platforms that you focus on, but it is one that you would have to use for SEO presence.
SEO.
So I agree with you. So you do have to pick one or two, but then there's maybe one or two more that you may have to do for other reasons.
Right. But like LinkedIn is primarily not so much for
no, it's a B2B.
But it's like a bio for your for
right.
Your business.
It's a B2B. So it's interesting. So you don't want to, like you say, it's not like a spray painting thing, but it is like, okay, you pick one or two that you're going to be doing like literally the engagement piece, where you are going to be like in communication and engagement. And that's the interesting part about social media, is that they each have a place. But then there's other ones you would want, like, it's like a waste of time. And then there's other ones that you really would have that engagement piece, like you said. Like, I think, like, Facebook is more of an organic community tribe orientation. That's just the way it's built. So, yeah, it's very interesting once you get into the whole, we're not going to do that. That's a whole other conversation.
But what you need to do is be consistent.
Exactly.
Sure.
Consistency is king. Mm-hmm. So, but let's not get into that, because that's a whole other interview and a whole, that's like a, that's a whole... Okay, so now let's get back into where we were, because otherwise you and I could talk forever.
Right.
So
talking about communication.
I know you and I could go forever and ever. So the one thing I thought was very interesting you also talk about is, and actually I understand the point of view, is you said fire to be fair. And other people are like, what? They're going to be like, what do you mean? What do you mean? So let's touch upon that, because I'm sure a lot of people are like literally like cringing when they hear that.
I'm sure, HR people, but I think it's, the reason I put it in the leadership section of the book is because people, it's a morale issue. For those that are left, and they are high performers, they know that there is a low performer on the team, and they are having to pick up slack for it. They know that this person is just riding the waves. They're just surfing along, not doing their job, and the high performers and the average performers are doing extra work to make up for this other person. And they're looking to see if you, the leader, are going to do anything about it. And if nobody enjoys having to fire someone, if you do, you don't belong to me. You don't have a heart as a leader. Nobody enjoys having that negative conversation. But if you think of it like this, I am helping that poor performer move on to somewhere where they can be successful. They are obviously stressed on the job because they realize they're not performing well. They know what the standards are, and they know they're not meeting them. And it's like they are every day coming to work thinking, when's the axe going to fall? Is it going to be next week or next month? Should I go ahead and buy this house? Should I upgrade? Should I buy that car? Because I know it may be next month or next week. Or when's the next performance review coming out? Because I know I'm not performing well. It has to be stressful. And when you have that conversation as a leader to say, here are the standards, you're not meeting them, you know that, I know that, the team knows that, I want to help you move on to another job, give you a little nudge to move on to the other job somewhere else so you can be successful, it's fair to everyone. It's fair to that performer. It's fair to you as a leader so you can focus on the other team and on your job so that you're improving the situation like a leader should be doing, and it's fair to the other employees.
Absolutely. So knowing that you and I could talk forever, I don't want to do that. I want people to be present. So I'd love for you to let people know where they can get this beautiful book, Communicate Like a Leader, Connecting Strategically to Coach, Inspire, and Get Things Done. So I want you to let people know the name of your website, how they can get in contact with you, and where they can get your book.
Yes. If they go to communicatelikealeaderbook.com, there's a website, and they can order it from any online store, from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any online store has it. But if you want that link to go there, communicatelikealeaderbook.com. And my own website is boorresearch.com. So they can
And they let's can find spell your they name.
Have, pardon me?
Spell your name so they know.
Yes, it's like Boo Her, except I hope they don't. B-O-O. H-E-R, Diana Boor. Diana is with two N's, D-I-A-N-N-A dot Boor, B-O-O-H-E-R, at BoorResearch.com.
Perfect. And as always, it's so just great to talk to you because you're such an amazing person and you have such just amazing knowledge and you're just an amazing person. I love you. So
well,
it's always great to reach out to you. And everybody, it's just great to always be with you guys as well. You can always reach me at CarlyAlyssaThorne.com, CarlyAlyssaThorne. I wish everyone a wonderful afternoon, and I shall be with you another time. Have a great day, everyone.